This is 11 WTTW Chicago.
Mystery is made possible by a grant from Mobil Corporation.
The art and imagery of Edward Gorey have been part of my life since, well, practically the beginning. The popular series Mystery premiered on PBS in 1980, the same year I premiered on Planet Earth. It's still going. That now iconic opening sequence features Gorey's pen and ink drawings. He was first hired to animate as well, but his initial storyboard suggested a sequence with a running time of nearly 10 minutes. They only needed 75 seconds, and eventually handed over animation duties to others. But then again, the strict adherence to time was never a major concern of Gorey's, who once said, "My favorite journey is looking out the window." There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. For someone associated so much with the look and feel of the Victorian and Edwardian eras, it's kind of funny that Edward Gorey died in the year 2000. He was most definitely not a 21st century man. Today we sit down with Mark Derry, author of the new biography, Born to be Posthumous, The Eccentric Life and Mysterious Genius of Edward Gorey. Mark spent the better part of a decade working on the book, digging into the life of someone he ultimately calls unknowable. When did Edward Gorey first appear in your life? Where did you first become aware of him and his work, or did you know his work before you knew of him?
I did not know of his work before I knew of him. My first encounter with Gorey was face-to-face. I was working at the Gotham Book Mart, a storied New York bookstore, now sadly gone to the great remainder bin in the sky, that was New York's answer to Shakespeare and Company in Paris. You know, a bibliomane's platonic ideal of a picturesque antiquarian and used bookstore, complete with the tinkling brass bell on the door and the atmosphere thick with book dust and Henry Miller.
And that smell.
And, yeah, that incredible musty book smell. And Henry Miller used to cadge loans from the owner, Francis Steloff. Patti Smith could be seen swanning around the aisles. And I had gotten a job at the Gotham shortly after moving to New York. It was the sort of place where you could look up, as I did one day, and hear the tinkling of the bell and see entering the shop in a swirl of snowflakes a magisterial old man with a corona of snow-white hair and a floor-length fur coat, you know, his shoulders lightly dusted by snowflakes, being led by a raven-haired beauty. And, of course, it was none other than Jorge Luis Borges. So that was the type of shop it was. J.D. Salinger would come scuttling in and go straight back to the boss's office where he would have books brought to him so that he could browse in peace. Jackie O routinely phoned in with orders for big stacks of books and so forth. And one day I looked up from shelving books to hear this high fluting voice and to see this preposterous apparition in white kids and a floor-length fur coat dyed heart attack, Easter peep yellow, silfing around the store, and it was none other than Edward Gorey. And under my breath, I said to another clerk, "Who is this freakish apparition?" And they said, "Oh, that's Edward Gorey. He's sort of our mascot. He does these marvelous little books, and they're sold at the checkout stand, and no one really knows what genre they fit into, and no one really knows where to shelve them. But he has a rabid cult following." And I cocked an eyebrow and thought, this is a person to remember.
So to that point, he is very frequently described as an illustrator or an artist, but your book makes a great point of the fact that he was not easily categorized. He was so many things, and not in a dilettante sort of way. He excelled, actually, in so many different areas. When you first had those initial sightings in the bookstore and you started delving into his work, what was your entry point for getting to know him on that side?
Well, like nearly everyone in the early 80s, and that's when I popped up at the Gotham Book Mart in 1983, the point of entry for Gori cultdom, for the Gori religion, was the Amphigori series of omnibus collections of his little books. And they were a fabulous point of entry. And Andreas Brown, the owner of the Gotham Book Mart, who was Gori's de facto manager and who really took him mainstream, although in his lifetime he was really never more than that curiously American oxymoron, the mainstream cult phenomenon. So in the same way that people like Tim Burton, no matter how famous they've become, always have kind of a culty aura around them, or someone like Tom Waits or Guillermo del Toro, there's still the feeling that you're part of an anointed cabal of just a few fans, even if these people are ginormous. Andreas Brown was the architect of his mainstream cult fame, such as it was. He was kind of Colonel Tom Parker to Gori's Elvis, as the owner of the Gotham Bookshop and also a publisher of many of Gori's little books, which he brought out in limited editions for Gori files and then would sell the rights to mainstream houses who would reprint them. Now, a lot of these books, by the time Gori made a big splash on Broadway by designing the sets for the Broadway production of Dracula starring Frank Langella, a lot of Gori's little books, which had been done in very limited editions and sold quite poorly and could be found in the nickel book bin at used bookshops in New York like the Strand, had gone out of print. And so Andreas Brown cut a deal with a major commercial house to collect a lot of Gori's little books in these anthologies, these omnibus editions, of which Amphigori was the first. And so that was kind of the gateway drug for Gori cultists.
Why spend so much time writing a giant 500-page book about Edward Gori? What was it that you decided to say, this is what I'm going to devote myself to for however long you've been working on this?
Well, I don't think any biographer sets out to spend 7 years of his life rolling that Sisyphean stone. But, you know, you might as well ask Jack Torrance in The Shining why he wandered into the hedge maze. You know, you think you're going to unriddle the riddle in 5 minutes and be out in a jiffy. But unfortunately, it turns out to be much more complicated than that. But Gori, happily, was absolutely beguiling, and his personality and intellect are virtually measureless to man. And so wandering through the tall grass of his mind was purely delightful. And the thing about Gori is that he was not only vastly erudite. When he died, let's remember, he had 25,000 volumes in his private library, more than his local library in the tiny Cape Cod village of Yarmouthport. And Gori had an obsessive-compulsive streak, and he would make a note on the end pages of his books in pencil, carefully noting the date that he began the book and ended it. And relatives and the estate pawing through his books after he dropped off the twig were astonished to discover those annotations in many of the 25,000 volumes. So he was prodigiously well-read and intellectually omnivorous. And so to write about Edward Gori required not only a mastery of different discursive modes, different angles of analytical attack. In other words, this is a book that is both narrative nonfiction. I'm telling the story of his life. It's psychobiography. I'm delving deep down through the sedimentary layers of a very mysterious, very self-concealing, cagey, aloof, evasive, reclusive, solitary, cat-like personality. There's the mystery of his sexuality. He claimed to be asexual, but everyone who met him was impressed by to use the term of art that was popular in the pre-Stonewall era, how quote-unquote flamboyantly gay he seemed to be, and yet he always insisted that he was quote-unquote reasonably undersexed, whatever that means, why that should be reasonably, no one has quite sleuthed out. But so you have to take a psychobiographical angle of attack, you have to spin a good yarn, you have to have a mastery of art history, because Gorey is somebody who was ridiculously well-versed in art history and drew from everyone from Tennille, the illustrator of Alice in Wonderland, to Gustave Doré, to Aubrey Beardsley, the aesthete and contemporary of Oscar Wilde, the great artist, to people who might be claimed by surrealism, such as Francis Bacon, the British painter, and Balthus, sort of vaguely, you know, pedophilic, strange, mysterioso Swiss surrealist, to American outsider artists like Albert York. So Gorey's drawing from many, many influences in art history. You have to be familiar with those. He was steeped in surrealism. He said, if I'm anything, as a life philosophy, I'm a surrealist, but also absurdly learned when it came to Asian philosophy and literature, which interested him, absorbed him immensely. So Taoism, Zen Buddhism, the ancient Chinese novel Tale of Genji, Japanese poetry from the floating world era, the woodcuts of Hokusai and Hiroshige, silent film, the silent films, the French director Louis Fouillade, French experimental literature like the Oulipo movement, and on, ballet, George Balanchine, Diaghilev. So I had to burrow deep into all of this stuff to get to grips with Gorey's influences in order to make sense of his books. So you can see in an instant how this easily took 7 years.
Yeah, it sounds like it should have taken much longer. We're getting close to 20 years since his death, and in that time, you make the point that, you know, his this level of fame, which was always on that line between cult and mainstream, sometimes a little more, a little less, has grown much more in that time period. Can you talk a little bit about how his reputation and place in the cultural world has grown in the nearly 2 decades since his death?
It's a fabulous question, and I'd like to quote, if I may, from a 1950 letter that the New Yorker sent Gorey when he was still at Harvard, and in preparation for being, you know, ejected out of the breach of Harvard and into the cruel real job market, he had started sending out his cartoons and drawings to various publications, and the New Yorker sent him a rejection letter. And the editor wrote, "While I readily recognize their merit, I'm afraid your drawings are not suitable for the New Yorker. The people in your pictures are too strange, and the ideas we think are not funny. By way of suggestion, may I say that drawings of a less eccentric nature might find a more enthusiastic audience here." So that's 1950, and as I note in the book, this is the New Yorker of Harold Ross, who scolded E.B. White about his use of the unthinkably vulgar phrase toilet paper, which Mr. Ross deemed so sickening it might easily cause vomiting. So that was the America of 1950. And the short answer to your question is simply that contemporary sensibilities have caught up with Gorey. And the paradox, of course, is that Gorey helped make American culture and the zeitgeist and the worldview what it is, help create the sensibility that is more accommodating to Gorey and has made him more of a mainstream figure. And so Gorey in the 1950s, even though unlike Maurice Sendak or Dr. Seuss or Tomi Ungerer, his books are not read by children because the mainstream houses that published them were petrified that his camp macabre, whimsically morbid brand of goth would, you know, turn American children into a nation of terrified bedwetters and bring out, you know, the pitchfork and torch brigade of people who want to ban books in force. Even so, Gorey was part of the revolution in what some sociologists have called kinder culture, you know, children's culture. And that's the landscape of toys and TV programs and kids' books. And so he's part of a phenomenon that whose best-known exponents are Sendak and Seuss, but also includes Tomi Ungerer and others, which is sort of the darkening of children's literature and the banishing of C.J. Run type books and the birth of a children's literature that is more reflective of the genuine lived experience of being a kid as opposed to a kind of a Victorian hangover of children as little angels and books as morality tales that end with a scriptural uplift. And so confronting subjects like death and, you know, the darker side of life is something that appears in Seuss and certainly in Sendak. And Sendak was an immense Gori fan, idolized him, and was almost worshipful in his attitude toward Gori's storytelling ability and his artistry. And Gori's books gradually, well and truly, become children's books. They're not marketed to children at first, but as boomers grow up with Gori, reading him in their college years, they start to read Gori books to their children. And so now you have generations like Lemony Snicket of Series of Unfortunate Events and Ransom Riggs of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children and Neil Gaiman of Coraline and Tim Burton of Nightmare Before Christmas and Amanda Palmer of the Dresden Dolls, and the kind of darkening, the gothification of childhood and popular culture and the rise of the goth subculture have all, to some degree, sprung from Gori's brow.
Do you think that Edward Gori was an invention, his greatest invention was himself in a way? Do you feel like even though you went on this 7-year journey and you spent so much time on it, is he someone who is ultimately knowable?
I think he's ultimately unknowable, and Gori is a riddle who refuses to be unriddled. And that sort of self-concealing quality is very much of a piece with his aesthetic sensibility. Of course, he read mysteries by the metric ton, and as a child, you know, began to read at age 3, and by age 5 had read Frankenstein and Dracula and claimed to have read Henry James. He had a distinct memory of one of James's Victorian novels having to be peeled out of his little fingers while his parents admonished him to eat his dinner. So a lot of those tales are about Victorian repression and about the lump under the carpet that everyone sees but no one acknowledges. And Gori's own family life was mysterious. The family moved constantly when he was a child. He had no idea why. His parents divorced when he was quite young, and then, improbably enough, his father married a cabaret singer who had played the saloon singer in Casablanca. You cannot make this stuff up. She's the one who sings La Marseillaise in Rick's cafe, Corinna Mora. And then they divorce, and Gori's father remarries his mother. Gori's own childhood had kind of a gothic or mystery story quality to it. He was a devout reader of Agatha Christie and famously said when she died, he told an interviewer, "I thought I just can't go on." But Gori's work is really almost pre-Freudian in the sense that in Freud, the repressed returns. In Gori, the repressed stays repressed. But paradoxically, you know it's there. The sidelong glances of his characters, the averted eyes, the way that people cluster together in knots, but each person is staring in a different direction. There's a sense of a knot of solitaries being alone together and of something buried under the floorboards or swept under the carpet. And I think Gori's own personality telegraphs that as well.
When you list out all the accomplishments that he had and all the influences that you spoke of earlier, it's quite impressive, but do you think by the time he passed away at age 75 that he considered his life a success at the level that he had envisioned it when he was a younger person?
Oh, I don't think Gori ever set out to become a success, and in fact, he took a very sardonic view of New York friends who were always massaging their careers, and he would sort of let loose with a long, dismissive sigh and roll his eyes and mutter the word careers. The whole idea of training your crosshairs on a certain level of success would at best have been absurd to Gori and at worst anathema. He cultivated the persona of a Victorian aesthete, a flaneur, an idler. And the essence of the idler is that you must never be seen to be striving. You sort of
ambition is vulgar.
Yeah, it's like perspiring. You know, it's something the oafish striver does. You know, the idea is to drape yourself languidly over a fainting couch and nibble a candied prawn while sipping your absinthe. You know, and leafing, you know, world wearily through a copy of Aubrey Beardsley's Yellow Book or something. You never.
Sounds like a nice Sunday. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's the opposite of our age of, you know, self-help and daily affirmations and inspirational koans and mission statements and life coaches and all the rest of it.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Museum Field Trips. According to a recent study by the Southern Plains Field Trip Guild, these journeys provide 71% of all students with their first exposure to world-class art. And speaking of exposure, 100% of students surveyed in a supplementary study credit field trips with their first opportunity to giggle at naked statues. And while we're at it, Museum Confidential would like to extend props to all those valiant teachers, chaperones, and parent volunteers who remain calm, maintain order, and all the while keep that simple trip to the museum from becoming the Lord of the Flies. So, let's go, hop on the bus, keep your hands to yourself, and make sure you have a signed permission slip, or else.
So, what kind of relationship did Gorey have with his artwork in relation to the broader museum world during his life? I know he had gallery representation of different sorts and different types, but what kind of, you know, notice was he getting from the actual, you know, quote unquote museum industrial complex?
Virtually none. He did have a gallerist who periodically showed his work, but despite Deborah Solomon's rehabilitation of Norman Rockwell as, you know, the Dutch old master of Disney's Main Street USA. And that sounds too snarky. I mean, I appreciate the recontextualization of Rockwell, but that yawning gulf between so-called commercial art, you know, illustration, book jackets, and all the rest of it, and so-called fine art persists despite decades of postmodernist protestations that the gulf between high and low has been closed by postmodernism. And certainly, you know, ever since Andy Warhol, that should have given the lie to the idea that, you know, illustration was the ugly stepchild of so-called fine art. You know, in an age when Jeff Koons is fine art, can that distinction really hold? It seems patently absurd. And yet, a titanic figure in American graphical art like Jack Kirby, you know, the virtuosic Marvel comics artist, still has not received a one-man exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art or the Guggenheim, which I think is absolutely shameful. Is R. Crumb a fine artist? Is he merely a commercial artist?
Because, well, you mentioned outsider artists earlier, you know, someone like Henry Darger, for example.
Exactly.
You know, he's gotten kind of more respect in the sense that, you know, the work was certainly not done for commercial purposes, but in terms of illustrative and that kind of style, it's right up there with some of these people you're talking about. So it seems like, you know, the purpose of the work in some ways ends up defining the way it gets categorized as opposed to the quality of the work itself.
I think that's right. And I think that you put your finger right on the nub of it, which is that the reason that people, and like Reverend Howard Finster, of course, who ended up marketed to a fairly well, but who initially, you know, his work was a form of proselytizing. It was evangelical art, and it was meant to preach the word of the Lord through the end of a paintbrush. And Darger, of course, was a completely reclusive, obscure, marginal character, utterly unknown to anyone as an artist. It was only after his death that his work was discovered. But the tie that binds both outsider artists and so-called fine artists is supposedly that their motivations are pure, right? They're virtuous in a culture that kneels at the altar of mammon. Their motivations are not commercial, which, of course, is absolutely preposterous in the moment. I mean, what a risible fiction. Somebody like Jeff Koons, who comes from Wall Street and who set out to be a zillionaire and who learned the lessons of Salvador Dali and Andy Warhol very well, is a creature of commodity culture through and through. You know, and the art world is all about hammer prices on the auction block at this point. So the idea that illustrators should be pariahs because they are quote-unquote mere commercial artists is the most intellectually fraudulent, laughable hypocrisy. Never mind the fact that Gorey's work is fabulous. I mean, when you see his images in the flesh, as it were, if you ever have the opportunity to see a real Gorey face, you know, nose to glass, it's dazzling to behold. You can't believe he didn't do this stuff with a jeweler's loop. I mean, the miniaturism of it, it's unbelievably fine work. And the obsessive, fastidious detail, every, you know, flower in the wallpaper is individually rendered. Every cobble on a cobblestone street is unique and lovingly depicted. So his stuff has got all of the virtuosic dazzle of Tennille or Ernest Shepherd or Arthur Rackham or Edmond Dulac or Gustave Doré, you know, the great illustrators of the past.
You hear a lot about this in terms of television right now, in terms of science fiction and all these different things. And the word is world building. And people always say, you know, they're doing a lot of world building, you know, creating this space that seems like a valid representation of another place. And I think when you think of Gorey's work, he was world building. All of his work, to me, seems to take place in this Gorey world. It's not this world. It's not another place. It's Gorey's world. And everything, even though it's different topics, different stories, different works of art, different this or that, they all kind of take place in this space that's just as much his as Narnia was C.S. Lewis's and as Middle Earth was to J.R.R. Tolkien. Why do you think that world is so enduring to people?
That's a fascinating way of putting it. I'm not sure I agree entirely. I don't sharply disagree, but I don't think Gorey was conscious of constructing an alternate reality, world building, as you put it, certainly not to the degree that somebody like J.R.R. Tolkien was, who was, after all, a philologist, and for whom the joy was sort of the pedantic professorial joy of inventing imaginary languages and then building backstories to legitimate them. With Gorey, it's kind of the miasmic fumes that rise up out of the swamp of all of his reading. You know, this is a guy who chose, almost as an afterthought, to major in French at Harvard because, quote, he had read everything in English from the 19th century. And I don't believe for a minute that he was overstating that claim. So, you know, this is somebody who's mastered the entire corpus of 19th century British literature, a devout Anglophile that he was, and also the very arch drawing room comedies of 1920s gay authors, like Evelyn Waugh of Bright Young Things fame, but also lesser-known figures like Ronald Furbank and Ivy Compton Burnett. And I think Gorey was so deeply immersed in that literature that he had simply sunk himself headfirst, if you will, in that world. You know, his psychic geography, the landscapes that he wandered up and down upon in his dreams was pulled from that era. But always bear in mind, too, Gorey once said, what I seem to be doing isn't what I'm doing at all. It may seem macabre, but it isn't really. And he disliked that adjective. And so his friend Alison Lurie said that, you know, after World War II, the 1950s was sort of a shock to sophisticated people because you were supposed to be ecstatic that your husband applauded your perfectly poached eggs, and you were supposed to rejoice in Wonder Bread and your two-car garage and your immaculately manicured suburban lawn. And to anyone with an ounce of irony and a hint of cynicism, Eisenhower's America felt positively Stepfordian. So I think Gorey is using his mockery of Victorian earnestness and hypocrisy and moral sanctimony as a way of critiquing the 1950s America he's living in when he starts writing in these books. So we can never forget the kind of camp and ironic aspect of what Gorey is doing, that it may look like Victorian England, but he's using that formal language to talk about the culture around him.
The legendary Hope Diamond, housed in the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, is cursed. Well, that's the urban legend anyway. According to the Smithsonian, the so-called curse originated as a marketing ploy devised by jeweler Pierre Cartier to entice Washington, D.C. socialite Evelyn Walsh McLean to buy the gem. Cartier created a fantastic story about the jewel's provenance and how the stone brought grief to anyone who handled it. McLean purchased the jewel, an acquisition reported in the New York Times on January 29, 1911, with a recounting of Cartier's dark tale. Over the years, other publications picked up the story, helping to perpetuate the legend about the stone. McLean's later misfortunes, her husband ran off with another woman and later died in a sanitarium, a car struck and killed her son, and her daughter died of a drug overdose, contributed to the perception that the stone was cursed. After McLean's death, the diamond came into the possession of jeweler Harry Winston, who later donated it to the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in 1958. The jewel was sent to the museum by registered mail and delivered by postal worker James Todd, who suffered several misfortunes the following year: a broken leg, the deaths of both his wife and dog, and the loss of his house in a fire. Todd took it in stride. "If the hex is supposed to affect the owners," he said, "then the public should be having the bad luck, not me." While the Smithsonian was pleased to receive the jewel, the centerpiece of its mineral collections, the public was less enthusiastic. "If the Smithsonian accepts the diamond," one person wrote, "the whole country will suffer." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.